Hello, and welcome to the Learning Mate podcast, where we speak to subject matter experts in the fields of education, education technology, and workforce development to learn more about advances and issues in the industry from cradle to career. I'm your host, Keith Chandler. And in this episode, we are diving into data and its impact on improving student outcomes. We have two special guests who will be sharing their insights on how they have used data to enhance their mission of serving students, the challenges they faced along the way, and the positive outcomes they have achieved by utilizing actionable data. So sit back, relax, and get ready to learn from these lifelong learners. And let's do these introductions right now. Jeff Simmons is the superintendent of Idaho Digital Learning Alliance, also known as IDLA. Jeff has an extraordinary passion for teaching and has worked in public education since 2001 and is currently a doctoral student at the University of Idaho with a research focus on measuring the impact of in-person support provided to K-12 online students. Jeff holds a master's in education leadership from the University of Idaho and a bachelor's in social studies and English education from Northwest Nazarene University. Jeff, thank you for joining us today.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Keith.
You're very welcome. And our other guest is Ryan Gravett. He is the Director of Information and Technology at IDLA and has worked to develop the systems and support infrastructure that make online learning possible. Prior to his work at IDLA, Ryan worked in Idaho and California school districts, supporting and leading information technology in brick and mortar classrooms. Ryan also received the 2011 Presidential Award for Outstanding Support for Technology from the Idaho Educational Technology Association. And besides a passion for technology and programming, Ryan has a bachelor's in psychology from Westmont College and an MBA from Boise State University. Ryan, thank you for joining the podcast.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Excellent. So before we start off and learn a little bit more about IDLA and your journey with data, let's get into the details of why you work in education. So Jeff, let's start with you. What is your why behind making education your career?
I appreciate that question. Thanks, Keith. So I'm a third generation educator. Both of my grandparents on my mom's side were educators. I actually worked with blind students. So my grandma would teach students how to read Braille. My grandpa would teach students how to walk with the walking cane. And then my mom was a special education teacher. She also taught elementary and worked at the district level. My dad was a librarian. So I was destined, I think, to end up in education in some way, shape, or form. It was just always around us all the time. I went into education because I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to make an impact. And I don't know if it was always as conscious as maybe subconscious for me, but I started my teaching career at a rural alternative school that served five different school districts. It was part of a cooperative where those schools, being too small to have all of their own programs, could pool some funds. They had CTE programs, they had special education services, and then we were the alternative school. And I really enjoyed my time there. I just had a big passion for those kids because you could make the biggest difference in that environment, in my opinion, rather than working in a larger school with students that maybe didn't have as many needs. And so I think the shift to working online was just kind of a natural one for me. We tend to focus a lot on rural schools and providing equitable opportunities. And so that's a long answer of saying what my why is. My why is creating opportunities that provide equity for all Idaho students. That's what gets me up in the morning. It's in direct alignment with the mission and vision of this organization. And it's what I'm really proud of over my career.
That's beautiful. It sounds like education is definitely in your blood. Ryan, same question for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting to talk about that, Jeff. Education runs in the blood for the family, for me too. My grandfather's a superintendent. My wife is a teacher. And so, you know, being around teaching and learning all my life, really, and that kind of rubs off into your passions as well. Really, what my why is, I just love kids, and I love seeing kids learn and seeing kids grow and seeing kids experience the world and new opportunities and seeing them believe in themselves, something that they didn't think that was possible before. So whether that's my own children or it's children that we're teaching and that we're giving an opportunity through our organization. I love kids. And so that's first and foremost. And then second of all, I love learning too, whether that's me individually learning or that's enabling learning for students or for others. My background in psychology was the psychology of learning. And then coming down into the work that I did in my MBA, a lot of that was around learning and growth as well. And so, you know, a lot of the opportunities I have on the technology side is just to utilize tools to empower that learning and to tear down those barriers to great teaching and learning. And so I'm mission driven. I love making a difference, and that's why I'm in the job. And I know that there are so many other individuals that are in it for the same reasons. And working within an organization that where you're surrounded by people that are in it because they love doing it and they love kids just makes coming to work every day super enjoyable. So I love that's a little bit of my grad background. Just love kids.
That resonates. I mean, I think we all live for those light bulb moments as educators, right? So let's go back in time a little bit. Let's talk about kind of the beginnings of IDLA. I'd love to learn, you know, where the origin of IDLA comes from, and talk a little bit about your mission of IDLA and how you serve students.
So IDLA was created in 2002 by the State Administrators Association, and with the goal of creating equity, opportunity, and access for students across the state. The room that we're sitting in right now has those three words in big bold letters on the wall, and you can find all three of those words in the legislation that created IDLA. You can find it in our mission statement, and it's really what we live to do. So 2002, online learning was new. I'll use air quotes for new because correspondence learning itself wasn't new, but doing correspondence learning online was new. And I think there was some vision on behalf of our administrators and legislators in our state that this could be a support for all schools across the state. So IDLA was formed to be the state virtual school. We are a supplemental program for all students enrolled through a public school or public charter school in Idaho. And what that means is that we can be we can level the field for all students across the state, regardless of what district you're from, what area you live in. You have access to the same opportunities through IDLA as every other student. And so that was a big piece of why we were created. And we've grown since we started tremendously as far as different programs, courses, and enrollment size. But the mission hasn't grown. It's stayed the same, focusing on that equity, opportunity, and access for students.
That's awesome. So let's fast forward a little bit. So it's 2016 now. You said you were founded in 2002. So in 2016, you find out that you are just kind of swimming in an ocean of data. And so what sort of data did you have your hands on at the time? And what was the end goal in kind of wrangling this data into something actionable?
It took some experiences of learning the hard way in many ways that you were swimming in data, right? And in online learning, more than in any other type of learning, the data is there, right? Every click that you take, every interaction that occurs, every grade that is done is digital. And so as opposed to the face-to-face, you know, a grade might be a grade book with a pencil. And that's very different in online because there is all those data elements. And we realized that there was lots of data around, but we just weren't taking advantage of it in the way that we really could to improve student outcomes. And so it really got down to just what you said, and that's actionable data. And we had to take a step back and say, how do we look at this data? Right now, we're looking at data as just an entire bucket. Can we segment this in a way that is more actionable? And so we did a lot of work, and we segmented it really into four different buckets. The first bucket was behavior, and that's activity that students take, the activities that a teacher takes, the interactions or the communications that occur. That's all behavior. That's all behavior in the class. Then, you know, what are they learning? We call that academics. What are those grades? How do we have these measures of learning or the measures of growth that are going on within the classroom, meeting those targets of teaching and learning? So that's academics. The third one is really perception. What do they think about their learning that's going on? What do they think about the growth that's happening for them? What do they think about their teacher? What do they think about their classes? What do they think about themselves? All these types of elements are perception and perception-related data. Most common form of that is like end-of-course surveys, right? What did you think about this? But if you think about like the star system on Amazon, that's a perception area. That's what I thought about that. And then the fourth area is just finances. What are the fiscal and measurable inputs that we put into these different activities, and what are those outputs that you receive? And so really, we categorized our data into those four buckets and started looking at parallels between them, because so often we look at that single data measurement at the end of the class, what's the grade that you received, and consider that to be the measurement of learning or the measurement of success or what that might be, when there's all these other data elements that have correlations and paths and causations, you might say, to those academic outcomes and the learning that actually occurs in the classroom. So once we started breaking those down into buckets, that's when we really started to have insights into data that was actionable in terms of how behavior impacted academics, how perceptions impacted academics, and you know, how finances impact academics.
So knowing what kind of the end goal was, what was the solution and how did you come up with that solution?
So really what we did is we started talking to people and we started talking to them about these different buckets. We sat down with teachers, we sat down with students, we sat down with parents, and we started talking to them about these different buckets and what was important to them. What were actionable steps? What would they like to take if they had data? So that's one step that we took, is a lot of interviews, over 50 interviews across different stakeholders for more than an hour, just really drilling down into those areas, understanding their perceptions on that. The second thing that we did is we actually did a lot of statistical analysis. We partnered with the regional labs. We did machine learning. We did a lot of work with statisticians and started drawing those connections between those things that I talked about. Like, does a phone call home have a correlation, or the amount of communication that occurs, does that have a correlation to academic outcomes? If it does, then that is a specific actionable item, right? A communication home is an actionable item. And then we took away all the things that weren't actionable. And that's actually harder to do. A lot of times you'll get insightful data that isn't actionable data. And so in online, telling me what gender the student is and aggregating data according to gender isn't really actionable. It could be insightful in a way that leads to additional analytics that then leads to something that's actionable, right? We find that there's a disparity, we do additional work, we figure that out, and then we get to an actionable element. But really it came down to trimming away the things that weren't immediately actionable to the people that were consuming it, because otherwise it just looks like more work, right? I'm going to give you a bunch of data, and now you have to do all the analysis to figure out what's actionable. And to a teacher, that's just like, you're asking me to do a ton more work. And so really it was those three elements, right? First of all, asking what was important. Second of all, doing that statistical analysis. And then third of all, trimming away the things that weren't actionable.
One thing that you touched on a little bit was involving parents in this process, which I think is awesome. And you mentioned, you know, the calling home and, you know, learning about, you know, if that makes an influence on, you know, a student's outcome. Was that something that you did? And did that have a positive outcome when, like, phone calls were made home to a student or to a parent?
Yeah, we have communication as a big piece of our expectations for teachers, especially being physically separated from your student. It's really important that A, the student knows you're an actual human being, and B, that they have regular interaction with you, whether that's a phone call, an email, a text message through Google Voice, something like that. I think one of the challenges you have with that as a teacher is, you know, there's the old teacher trick that you want to make your first call home a positive one, because the next one probably won't be. But, you know, when you're looking at a large number of students and all of the tasks that you have to do every day, that's hard to do. And then, you know, so you end up with with that one call to the kid that you know is struggling, but usually that's a reactive response to a student struggling. The student has to be failing before they get to the point where they get up far enough on my radar that I have time to make a phone call for them. So what would be better is if we can be proactive in that communication, try to intercept the kids before they reach that point. And so that was one reason, that type of need is one reason why we chose to try to figure out how to make our data work for us in a proactive way.
Again, approaching those three different buckets, we see it in perception information. So when parents talk about what mattered to them, often you'll hear about the phone call home that they enjoyed from that perception perspective. You see it in the behavioral perspective in terms of what happens after a phone call home occurs. Well, students start logging in again if they weren't logging in, right? And so that's a trigger there. And then you see it actually, that impact of communication. It's not just phone calls, it's across the board, that impact of communication on the outcomes for that student as well. And those teachers that are doing a good job connecting with that student, connecting with that parent, you see a teacher impact of about 20% on the academic range one way or the other, right? And so you see the academic outcomes change based upon the communications and that teacher communicating with that student and that parent.
Speaking of teachers, what is the student to teacher ratio like in this environment? And how did you kind of settle on, you know, making the decisions on what those ratios should be?
Good question, Keith. So on average, our classes have about 20 students per teacher in them. And, you know, that's an average. So you might be up closer to 30, you might be, you know, closer down to 12, something like that. But that's an intentional decision on our part as we've grown. We have wanted to make sure that anything that we can do with quality. And we know that what makes the biggest difference in a student's education is that connection and relationship with their teacher. So that means class sizes have to be reasonable, and that creates the best quality experience, both for the students and for the teacher. So even as our enrollments have grown, we've been able to maintain our average class size right around 20.
Thank you, Jeff. And how many total students is IDLA currently supporting right now?
This year, we don't have our final number yet because we're still in the middle of the spring, but we're projecting to be somewhere around 47,500 enrollments, somewhere in that neighborhood. That's one student taking one course. If you divide that number in half, that's about the number of students that we have for the year. So 23,000-24,000 students, unique students this year.
Wonderful. Let's talk a little bit about Clarity, because I know this is a tool that you used to kind of harness and kind of gather all of this data into one actionable place, because it existed in a few different silos. So what was your journey with Clarity like?
Yeah, the journey with Clarity really comes back to that 2016 date that you referenced earlier. And that was when it really dawned upon us that by connecting these buckets together of data that we have, we can create a solution that gives us more actionable data. When you have all these systems divided, then the only thing that they can do is give you actionable data based upon the silo in which they exist. So if you have end of course surveys and the only thing it can talk to is end of course surveys, then you can give information based upon that question that you asked in that survey, but you can't draw that correlation back to, you know, how many communications went to this parent that resulted in this experience or that perception that parent had of a great teacher interaction, right? So drawing those parallels allows you to draw actionability. And we realized that we had each one of these data sets in different locations. And by doing that, we were limited in the actionability of results that we could deliver. And so we had to take a step back and say, how do we connect this data together in a timely fashion so that we can deliver timely, actionable information to our parents, to our students, to our teachers, to our schools, and to our own organization? And so really, it became the only way that we could do that was connecting that data together foundationally. And that's what Clarity does for us. And we've turned our data warehouse, we've called it Clarity, but that's what it does for us. It aggregates that data together, surfaces up those actionable elements, and then we consume those in different ways, whether it's a mobile app, or it's a website, or it's a report, that gets surfaced in multiple ways depending upon the stakeholder.
And it's real time. So Ryan mentioned end of course surveys. Those are great, but that's an autopsy. That happens after the learning experience is already done. So as a principal, if I'm going through the end of course survey data, I might find a nugget in there that's good feedback for my teacher. I can give that to them for their next group of students, but it did nothing for the students who just responded to that survey. So making data actionable also means giving it to us in a timely fashion so that it can be proactive and not reactive, so that we can adjust our practice before it's too late to make those changes and make significant impacts on students.
Autopsy. That's a fun term.
It's the autopsy.
Yeah.
I like that term. I like that.
I don't know. Lagging indicators. Nah, let's call it an autopsy. It's called dead data. That's hilarious.
I speak to a lot of teachers, and you know, one of the biggest items of feedback that they talk about as educators is the fact that they don't get the feedback that they want in time. They always get it at the end of class. And so I know some professors in the higher education field that are doing, you know, evaluations, you know, two or three times during the semester so that they're constantly getting feedback. And so I can see how a tool like Clarity would definitely help you along that journey.
You're describing my challenge, which has been part of, I think, our journey with Clarity, Keith, and in that, you know, as a teacher, I'm provided a data dashboard and he's got these little red, yellow, and green dots on it. So I log in and it says, well, Ryan's a red dot. Well, I already know Ryan's a red dot because Ryan has been failing my class for 3 weeks. So why is Ryan a red dot? That's really the important information for me, is what's making Ryan a red dot, because then I can help Ryan become a yellow dot and hopefully a green dot someday. So my challenge with a lot of the data dashboards that we do have access to is that it's just describing the water I'm already drowning in. I already know I'm drowning. I don't need you to tell me I'm getting wet. I need you to help me find the lifeline so I can get out of it. And that, honestly, that was part of my struggles with some of the early developments we had with data work. So I remember one day Ryan had been working really hard on some machine learning and he comes bouncing into my office. And he's like, I got it. We can predict which students are most likely to fail. I'm like, okay. Tell me what's going on here. I was in a different role then. I worked more with our teachers. And he very excitedly told me that if you're a male Hispanic student in a rural school district, you're more likely to fail one of our classes. And I looked at Ryan and I said, well, what am I supposed to do with that? And he's like, well, you're supposed to call the parent or something. And I'm like, okay, hey, sir, your child is likely to fail. You're welcome. Like, I'm like, what am I supposed to do with that? And so I think I crushed Ryan quickly on that day. And I still feel bad about that. But it was just illustrating for me that we weren't where we needed to be with what we could do with our data. And so, again, we keep using the word actionable. But Ryan's team has done a really good job of making sure that anything that's in a Clarity dashboard is something that I can do something with. It needs to nudge me in a certain direction as a learner, or it needs to bring me information as a teacher or as a parent or as a principal that can help me create change for the positive for that student. And that to me is when data becomes really powerful, because instead of just painting the picture that we already know, it's showing me what could be on the next page.
You're touching on challenges a little bit. Are there any other challenges that you faced along your data journey? And also, alternatively, what were some of the positive outcomes that, you know, came out of your data journey?
You know, Ryan could talk a little bit about some of the specific challenges we had in developing the system itself. I think anytime you embark on a journey where you're creating something that hasn't been created yet, there's what you think is going to happen, and then there's what actually happens. And so we had a lot of those type of learning opportunities. I think making something actionable was the most difficult part, because it you couldn't just take your descriptive statistics, or like Ryan mentioned, gender. You couldn't just take the stuff that's easy to get to and put that out there and say that that met the need. You had to really find data that aligned to the specific needs for each user in each role. For me, the positives is that now each user in our system has access to a dashboard that should support them in their role. So if I'm a student, I have access to a dashboard that says, hey, here's your grade now. Here's what your grade could be if you turned in those five assignments you're missing. As a parent, it gives me data on how I can help better support my student at home. Same with the teacher, same with the individual at the school monitoring the student or the principal. Everybody has relevant data to their role, to the point of time that they're in during the course, and it should be prompting action. And so we're moving away from taking the time to find that data and aggregate it and interpret it and then analyze it and doing all of that work for that person so that they can focus on putting it to work, to using it and creating change. And to me, that dynamically changes the game for everybody in the system. So that for me is the biggest positive.
Yeah, that was really hard, Jeff. And I think that it took a ton of work. It always takes work to take data to an actionable location. It's a matter of who's doing that work. And so my wife's a teacher, and one of the things that she'll do when she gets home is she'll look over the test results of all the students and make little notes on the side. This student has an EA vowel team that they're struggling with. This student has an OU vowel team that they're struggling with. And like one by one, spend hours going through this data to aggregate, you know, where they're struggling at, and then surface up what the next lesson is going to be, right? And she does that like every day. And so she's taking data, which is just the raw test results, and then moving it from that to insightful, and then moving from insightful to actionable, and then delivering that lesson. But she's doing all that work. What's the easy stuff? The easy stuff is just to spit out the grades. The hard work is to go through and aggregate that together, group that data together, and surface that up in an actionable way. And so the better, what we're trying to do is say, teacher, you don't have to do that work. We're going to take and do that additional work to get it to the point of actionable. We're going to give you that list of vowel teams that you're struggling with. We're going to give the list of groups of students that are struggling with this. And that actually took a lot more work on our side than we thought it was going to take. Each one of those actionable elements takes data scientists understanding data, working with a teacher who says, no, this is a vowel team. That's not a vowel team, you know, and so it's a whole bunch of work just to get to that one element to move on to the next element. And that's the process that took a lot, but I would much rather us do that institutionally than ask every single one of our teachers to spend 2 to 3 hours every night working on that. And all too often, I think in education, we discount how much work those teachers are doing and don't put the institutional work in to lessen that load.
Yeah, I think a strength of the development for this tool was making sure all the voices were heard. Ryan referenced that. You mentioned that earlier, Keith, about bringing in parents. But that really helped us end up where we needed to be, because we had, you know, users like myself who I can't code. I can't do a function or anything like that. But I can tell you what I need in order to do my job. And then we match that feedback with somebody who does understand really well the coding, the technology pieces that need to happen to bring me what I need. And then we continually met and gave feedback and worked together to troubleshoot through issues and test things. And that takes a long time, but it was good work, and it helped us end up with a really good product that we're very proud of.
I also love the examples that you gave just from the student and the teacher perspective, just because it sounds like this is something that really allows students to focus on learning and for teachers to focus on teaching and for parents to focus on being parents. As you said, this really takes the responsibility of them needing to do all of this extra work and allowing them to do what they're there to do, which is to teach and to learn and to be a supporter of these students from each of those perspectives.
And to Ryan's team's credit, not all of those dashboards look the same or come to you in the same way. So the student dashboard, the school and the principal dashboards are available a little bit differently. The parent dashboard is going to be an app that pushes information to me on my phone. So we also tried to recognize who each person is in their role and how they would want to receive information. Because again, I could give you really cool data in a way that you don't consume it and it doesn't matter. So it's not just the content, but also the message itself that's important.
Awesome. And so as we're talking about data, especially student data, now that, you know, AI is a big trigger word for everyone, there's always concern regarding privacy and student data. So how did IDLA address concerns about privacy with data, and how is data being kept private that should be kept private?
Ryan can talk about the how better than I can, but basically we're leveraging relationships that we have in our student information system to make sure the right person's getting the right information. But what I also saw us doing was a lot of testing. We've done a lot of testing before anybody gets their hands on a dashboard. And that's not just making sure that the data is being protected and only going to the right user, but it's also making sure it's reliable and valid. If I roll something new out to you and it's wrong, it's worthless from that point on, no matter how shiny it becomes after that. And then the other thing I would just add is you can never invest in that too much. Education is one of the top industries for targeting, you know, phishing attacks and things like that, because we have lots of data. So we're a huge target. So that investment isn't just in software and password managers and things like that, but it needs to be in training. It needs to be in auditing every year. We go through and audit our systems to make sure that if something were to happen, what access would somebody have to that, and how can we help be proactive to address that? So security is a big deal, especially in education.
The security model that we took, we built from the ground up, and that is what we call a row level security, or RLS in the technical field. And basically that differs from role, like ROLE. Why they choose two terms that like almost sound exactly like each other, I'm not sure, but that differs because in role-based security, you have this understanding that if you're a teacher, then you have access to the teacher things. Row level security, or RLS, is so granular. It says you are Jeff, and Jeff, you have access to three students. Not that you're superintendent and you have superintendent access, but you are Jeff. And because you are Jeff, you have this level of security. And so the level of security we implemented was that very granular level security of only having access to the data that you specifically have. And so it made testing really challenging because you know, generally in testing, you say, oh, just be Jeff and test out as being a superintendent and assume that role and then see what access you had. But we couldn't. We had to be Jeff to be able to test Jeff. And so all of a sudden, all of our testers had to think about new ways to test our data because they couldn't be Jeff. And so that gives you a little bit of an idea of the security, and that increased the amount of work we had in building from the ground up. But to get to your specific point about AI, I think we really need to make AI that choice that the parent makes. And then, you know, when that AI has data access, it only has the limited access to data it needs. And that's a de-identified access. And so it isn't that the AI is understanding Sally or Jimmy. The AI is understanding what the student activity is and then helping with that, rather than having the details it doesn't need to know about. It needs to be on a need-to-know basis, to use that military term. And so I think the way that you structure your data and this RLS, or row level security, really helps implement that barrier between what you want the AI to see and what you don't.
I would like to know, what advice would you give to, you know, a digital learning provider that is wanting to take their mountains of data that they have and turn it into actionable data, or, you know, turn it into a resource that will benefit both the students and the educators alike?
I would share a couple of things. One is that it can be simple. We've put together a very complex system to meet a specific need, but really the goal is getting the right data to the right person. So identify the need that you're trying to meet, identify the data that helps inform how you meet that need, and then get that data to the people who need it in order to create change. That can be as simple as a spreadsheet, potentially. It just depends on what you're what issue you're trying to solve. So that's one thing I would share. And the second thing I would share is invest in data literacy with your staff and with your students and with your parents. So again, just having the data doesn't mean I know how to use it. So investing in training on how you analyze and interpret data is important as well, because I need to understand what's in front of me and what I should do with that. And that's something that the technology itself can't deliver, but we can wrap that support around it as we bring it to folks and really help arm them so that they know how to use their data well.
Ryan, anything to add to that?
Oh, that was really good, Jeff. I think, you know, we started our journey by just understanding our own existing data a little bit more. So I would say if you as a district or you as an institution don't have a good map of understanding where all your data is at, start there. Start by understanding where all of your data is at and what types of data you have, and then imagine connecting those together and if there's value. And if there's value in connecting those data systems together and the ways in which you can deliver value to your organization, then it's time to start thinking about how you're going to do that. But it really starts with knowing what you have and knowing your data, and then just what Jeff said, and that is listening to the people about what they want to do or what they could do.
Wise words. Finally, last question. As a lifelong learner, do you have any piece of educational material that you would recommend to our listeners as myself or myself, like a book, a documentary, a podcast? Nothing's really off the table here. This is more of a personal recommendation that you would give to me.
It's a bit of an unfair question for an educator. It's almost like asking a parent to pick their favorite child. I have one child, and his fiance is my favorite child. But if I had to pick one, I'll give you one that I've really enjoyed is Grit by Angela Duckworth. That's a classic, in my opinion. It's in my research area that you mentioned earlier. And so that's one reason I gravitate to that. But something I like about that book is that it reinforces that resiliency is something that can be taught and developed. Being resilient is not an innate ability, something that we can develop in ourselves, develop in our students. And so that's a great read if you haven't come across that one.
That's a good one, Jeff. And speaking of going off the script, I'm going to talk about a book here. It's called Measure What Matters, and it's a good one to give a good idea on in terms of data and looking through data and data perspectives. There's some great online courses as well out there. I've been taking a couple of classes through Harvard Extension that have been pretty good. And so, you know, there's a variety of different resources out there, but I think you don't have to start your journey with a big book or something like that. You can just, you know, even I'm sure you discuss data even on this podcast a lot. And so every one of your listeners is a lifelong learner and a grower as well. So that's one book that I'd give, but there's lots of different resources that you can pick up on.
Jeff Simmons and Ryan Gravette, thank you so much for joining the podcast today. They are from the Idaho Digital Learning Alliance. If you'd like to learn more about the IDLA, you can visit idla.org. Once again, that is idla.org. Also, those lifelong learning recommendations are Grit by Angela Duckworth and Measure What Matters by John Dewar. And to learn more about Clarity, the integrated data platform that was built in partnership between IDLA and LearningMate, visit learningmate.com/learn-more and mention this podcast episode as a reference as you fill out that form on that landing page. Also, don't forget to check out learningmate.com/podcast. There you will find our library of episodes, live links to all the resources we reference during our episodes, and a little questionnaire. If you'd like to be a guest or have an idea for a topic, please feel free to reach out and start the conversation. The Learning Mate podcast is a production of Learning Mate Solutions Incorporated. Thank you once again to our guests today, Superintendent Jeff Simmons and Director of Information Technology, Ryan Gravette, both from Idaho Digital Learning Alliance. I am your host, Keith Chandler, and until next time, thank you for listening.